Hello, very good morning, and thank you for joining us here on The Very Last Word.
This is The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Independent TD Noel Grealish and Fianna Fáil Senator Lorraine Clifford Lee were both criticised this week for making comments deemed inappropriate. In light of both incidents, we were joined by journalists Lise Hand, Larissa Nolan and Gerard Howland to discuss what is appropriate now for a politician to say. One of the world's most prominent Irish-born people in recent decades is Samantha Power. She was with us to discuss her autobiography, The Education of an Idealist, her career and her thoughts on Donald Trump's presidency. And former Ireland and Wales rugby coach Warren Gatland talked to us about his history with Ireland, this year's World Cup and the 2021 Lions Tour.
The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
And Opel, celebrating 120 years of German engineering.
We're leaving the politicians out of this one while we talk about the things that the politicians say. This is on the back of a few things that have emerged in the last few days. We'll get to Lorraine Clifford Lee in a moment, but let's start with Noel Grealish. We have with us the journalists Larissa Nolan, Lise Hand and Gerard Howland, columnists for the Irish Examiner. Lise Hand, if I can start with you, and this was something that's just come up in the 5 at 5. Noel Grealish in the Dáil yesterday made reference to about £3.5 billion, which he suggested had been remitted to Nigeria from Ireland. He was actually in possession of an answer from the Department of Finance from the 22nd of October, which told him that figure actually was incorrect, and yet he still went into the Dáil and used it yesterday.
Not only was it incorrect, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, it was out by a couple of quid. I mean, we're talking about the two figures were wildly divergent. The figures that Noel Grealish quoted in the Dáil yesterday were basically based on a guesstimate, literally a guesstimate. I mean, the World Bank, I think they literally take... the sort of overall figure divided roughly by the number of countries and just work out a general, you know, a sort of a general figure. Whereas at least the stats that he got from, that were given to him by department, came up with a figure of 17 million per year, which as opposed to 3.4 billion over, you know, a certain number of
years. Which was based on the number of Nigerian-born people in the country and their income, as reported to the CSO, and what they would have available from their after-tax income to remit home to Nigeria.
Correct, yes, exactly. And the, you know, the figures that he were quoting were presupposing that everybody had basically disposable income of about 70,000 a year after paying taxes and rent and everything as well. I mean, you know, the figure was so wildly out of kilter with reality. But, of course, the question, you know, whatever about the figures, and you could say, well, you know, the figures provided by the CSO via the Central Bank might have been slightly, you know, inaccurate as well. But the fact is that he actually had them. And if he stood up and said, there are two sets of figures here, here is one and here are the other. But, of course, that whatever narrative, whatever point he was trying to make, the set of figures he got from the government didn't suit the narrative he was trying to create.
Listener says it's just fake news, get over it. But Gerard Howland, isn't the point here is that there will be people who will go around now this weekend in pubs and restaurants all over Ireland saying, do you hear your man Noel Grealish? He managed to put his finger on these figures that the Nigerians are sending home, and they're trying to shut him up when he's telling the truth. Isn't that what's going to happen?
It certainly will, and it's been happening for some time. Noel Grealish is basically getting on a horse that's left the stable some time ago. If you go back to the early noughties and the context of the then citizenship referendum, the sort of urban myths included they, and they, by the way, were all immigrants, and usually refer to black immigrants, just to call it really bluntly, were getting prams at the lower end of the scale to apartments and cars at the top end of the scale.
And people believe that.
It was a very widespread thing, and it was getting really dangerous, and it was real. So there's something out there. It's got a hold. It's in the ether. It's that's copycat protesting from town to town about asylum seekers. Now you have it raised to a new level, really for the first time, in Noel Grealish's comments in the National Parliament. And it is about slowly incrementalising the use of words in ways that are designed to other pick on, denominate in a very nasty way, people who are different from us.
And of course, Larissa, people can do whatever they want with their after-tax income, can't they?
Well, this is my basic problem with this kind of issue in the first place. It's a very busybody in its basis as well. I mean, essentially, it's nothing to do with Noel Grealish, what somebody who earns money sends back. We have laws in place to deal with that. There are Garda units who look into such things as this. That's their business. At the same time, it is worth saying that, of course, people can ask the question, because this will be turned to say, oh, nobody can say anything more, no one can say anything. We shouldn't fall into that trap. We should say, yes, people are allowed to ask the questions, and yes, the answers can be provided. But, you know, it's a very different thing in this case.
But sorry, isn't there a problem here, Larissa, in that he actually had received the answer from the Department of Finance in writing? He chose to disregard a figure which didn't suit his argument, and he used the inflated and disputable one.
Yeah, well,
instead,
I think it's important that we provide the clarity around that and how that happened, because it will be boiled down to, oh, nobody can ask anything now, and that goes against, it feeds into the narrative that this kind of thing is trying to create. But I do think that it's an interesting thing. Danny Healy-Ray made an interesting comment on it, which he said was, it's too easy to kind of dismiss somebody as, you know, oh, this is racism, or he is racist in relation to this. But, you know, what you have to do is, the question as Danny Healy-Ray asked was, I'm not sure what kind of point he was trying to make. And I think that's the bottom line of this. I don't know where he's going with this. He seems to be terribly preoccupied with this issue. I don't think he has an audience in Ireland for it.
But hold on. I mean, this money goes to all countries around the world from people who are living in Ireland. Why did he pick out the Nigerians?
Well, that's the question, is why he did pick out the Nigerians.
To disagree, unfortunately, with Larissa, I think very regrettably there is an audience. I hate to have to say that.
Well, you could argue, if you look back at the last presidential election, and you saw Peter Casey went from scraping along the bottom of the ratings up to 20-odd% after he got embroiled he got into the imbroglio over the travellers' accommodation and so on. There was obviously there are people that what he said chimed with, and there are obviously people that say, okay, there is obviously people who feel that their voices aren't being, you know, heard or whatever. And this, reprehensibly, I mean, this isn't a both sides argument. I think what Noel Grealish said was genuinely being disingenuous, and I think he knew exactly what he was saying. And in fairness, I will say, I think that the Taoiseach's reply, you know, he was caught on the hoof, was actually very measured.
From a Taoiseach who only last week was making comments
about Georgians and Albanians. But you see, like, this is the trouble, and the government should be whistles and alarms going off all over government buildings, because they now have a problem. They have a problem that people say, well, you know, is this money leaving the country, whatever. This is the kind of disingenuous arguments that have to be slapped down with facts, with figures, with statistics, with rebuttals that have to be swift, that people have to be told, here's actually what the money that's going, in the same way that something like, you know, Irish people were sent home 7 billion into the economy over a certain stretch of time, you know, look at the size of our diaspora. How much did them, you know, and they're all sending money home too.
Yeah, I would suspect a lot of that is corporate money that's been repatriated as well, rather than just money been sent by Irish people back to their homes. But here's a listener comment, and this is not untypical. The establishment has started the cover-up. No one is to question the great Nigerian swindle. What Nigerian swindle? Here we go again.
And I was, if you look at rates of unemployment, they are multiples in the immigrant community, and they are multiples again among people, non-white people in the immigrant community. So if you look at who are the most marginalised people in our society in terms of access to jobs, they are travellers, they are people of a different colour, and they are people with disabilities. And how come you arrive in our society fit and well, with ability, and you're immediately in the most constrained, darkest corner in terms of access to a quality of life? There is an ingrained racism in this country. It has always been there, and I think it is just bubbling up now.
Okay.
In particular.
What about Lorraine Clifford-Leeso, Fianna Fáil candidate in the forthcoming by-elections Dublin Fingal, who used the word pikey on three separate occasions on Twitter in 2011, also using the words traveller and knacker in derogatory manner, and who has, Fianna Fáil has said, she wrote those tweets in a personal capacity many years ago, before she was a senator. She was a member of the National Executive at the time, wasn't she? 2011.
I think the it doesn't really matter what she was, you know. I mean, the issue is, for me, I would find that we disagree on this one, Jared, in relation to, I think most Irish people are well thinking, and especially as, you know, I live in an area that is everyone around me is from all kinds of countries in Dublin 8, and they all find the Irish to be very very welcoming. But at the same time, I would also find that in general, you know, I think that Lorraine Clifford-Lee is an admirable politician in general, but I'm very surprised that she would use such what I would kind of call sort of vulgar language, you know, in her case. And I don't see it around me in general. I don't hear people using these kind of derogatory terms across a spectrum. So it's very surprising to hear her using them. And I think it's mostly very embarrassing for her. I don't think that any of us, other than those on the extreme end, believe that Lorraine Clifford-Lee is a kind of a prejudiced person or a person, you know, with who has hatred for anybody like that. I think it's very embarrassing for her because what it has done, unfortunately, is expose her not so much as someone with any kind of hate in their mind, but as someone who is a hypocrite. Because what has happened is that she has been the first person up to, you know, point the finger at somebody like
Jerry Bottomer was misogynistic and opposed to her. And I don't think people think of Jerry Bottomer as misogynistic.
And he isn't. And it was very, very unfair. And it was a dangerous kind of argument, I think, because, you know, women have to kind of fight enough in general in the political arena. And we don't need to be crying wolf in issues like this and diluting and trivialising the issue. But I mean, I think what has happened here is it's shame. You know, she was using shame in order to shut down an opponent. And what's happened here now is somebody else is using shame to kind of get her back and expose her hypocrisy. And I don't believe that shame should be something that is encouraged in society at all.
She's on a sticky wicket, I think. Again, these weren't tweets that she put out when she was a, you know, giddy 16-year-old. I mean, she was a working woman at the time in her 30s and should have known better. Apart from anything else, I mean, not wanting to be glib about it, but how anybody is running, has run for office or is sitting in office at the moment or is planning to run for office and hasn't literally purged their entire social media of anything from their past that might come back to bite them. Because there is, we saw with Votegate recently that there are people who are just want to troll through everybody's back catalogue of, you know, just find, see if there's any hidden greatest hits in there in terms of things that they can throw at them. So they're, you know, apart from anything else, how, you know, everybody's social media is now just up for grabs. Anybody can say anything.
But hold on, is it possible that Lorraine Clifford-Lee's comments will do her no harm whatsoever?
It is entirely
that
possible.
Actually she will benefit, perhaps, that some voters who might have voted Peter Casey in the last presidential election would say, fair play to her for saying it as she is, but brave enough to say the things we all want to say, but we're not allowed to say it by these PC liberals.
No, not in this case. I think if she does get any sympathy, it'll be from most of us who realise that we're all human and they see this as an attack on the person and possibly an unfair attack on the person. Although she has been the one pointing fingers herself.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine saying, you know, that some people might have sympathy for her, but I think there, you know, that it will be interesting to see, assuming that she does, you know, remain on the ticket for the by-election and isn't put under pressure to remove herself from it. I think it'll be interesting to see how she does.
But Gerard Holland, could it be that there will be many candidates around the country, particularly when you have places like there's direct provision centres or causes of controversy, that when we get our general election at some stage in the first half of 2020, that there may be many politicians who play this type of card?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that there will be instances where candidates bubble up. They don't get elected. Maybe they only get a couple of hundred votes. But those couple of hundred votes will be hugely significant in influencing the politics in that constituency thereafter. It could have a decisive income and the ultimate outcome of the last seat in the constituency. It will be an inherited memory that this now has to be worked around if you're going to survive. In relation to Lorraine Clifford-Lee, I think the issue there is about the language she used. It's so commonplace. I hear those words, or some of them at
Absolutely.
Least, about travellers on a regular basis. So it's not that she used them years ago, it's that they're still common currency today.
Yeah, but I don't hear anybody using them who portrays themselves as a paragon of virtue, who can stand up and point out to other people and call them out for sexist remarks and call them out for various other remarks. So the incongruity there is between her own kind of moral posturing and what she says herself.
Because she's holding other people to higher standards and they have to be applied to herself.
I think it's sorry, just to finish off, to add to your point, I think if we had received the general election some of us were expecting in November, I think you'd find that, you know, genuine, sort of the whole issue of racism would be front and centre of this now.
Listener says, I'm Matt, you and your snowflakes. Noel has widespread support. Maybe you should look on Facebook. That's why I deleted my Facebook account yesterday.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Social media is not real life anyway. I mean, there was a statistic recently about Twitter. I think 90% of content on Twitter is provided by 10% of tweeters. So that's actually not, it's not the real life thing. And the major problem that I would have with Noel Grealish, he's entitled to any opinion he likes, as unpalatable as it is, but just get your facts right. I mean, calling people spongers who have nothing to sponge and nothing to gain, you know, it's just technically, it's just factually not right.
Listener says, I'm English. Racist comments are common but not considered racism by the people saying them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've lived in the North Inner City for nearly 30 years. It's the densest mix of different peoples in the country. It is a wonderful place to live. I think we've hugely benefited from it. And I have seen, you know, in plain sight, on buses, I've seen bus drivers particularly abused. Who are of a different colour. I saw a Chinese guy in the street a few months ago, some drunken, I was going to say a word I shouldn't use, person.
I've got to be very careful.
I've got to be very careful. racially abuse him. It is there. I accept it's a minority, Larissa, but I think we underestimate this as our peril.
Absolutely, and there is open racism, but I think the more insidious type, which was, I think we saw in action in the Dáil yesterday, is what they call, you know, jacking, G-A-C-I-N-G, which is just asking questions and framing dog whistles, basically.
The great dog whistle in American politics was all about welfare and how you separated yourself.
Yeah, but the point is, I was just going to make is, you know, this whole thing of, you know, I'm just asking a question and now you're shutting me down and looking
absolutely.
For...
Absolutely.
And that's a dangerous... And it's very, very hard to refute that because, you know, it is just really hard to actually deal with that particular form.
I have to leave it there. Lise Hand, Larissa Nolan, Gerard Holland, thank you all very much for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
I'm delighted we're joined by Samantha Power, who has been one of the most prominent Irish-born people in the world in recent decades. Some of the most important positions she has filled in the US administration of Barack Obama. And she has published her autobiography, The Education of an Idealist. And we're delighted that Samantha Power is with us. Idealist, how would you describe yourself? In an idealist, in what way?
I think if you look around and you don't think the world is quite the way it ought to be, that's a form of idealism in and of itself, that you're noticing that. But I think the second step is the hardest for most of us, which is there anything I can do about it? Is there any piece of what I don't think is quite right that I can try to affect? And so I think my idealism combines those, you know, a sense that we're not quite where we need to be on climate change, on inequality, on race, on homelessness, on refugees, you know, you name it. And then the question is there some slice of that any of us has a role in trying to make a dent in?
So some people think of idealists as being somebody who wants to get to the ultimate position, and then pragmatism at times gets in the way. How often did you find that in your own career, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, other things, that what you wanted, the ideal that you wanted to reach couldn't be achieved, but there was still satisfaction maybe having a step towards it?
Yeah, I think the way you put it is I, you know, in the end, the lesson of my so-called education as an idealist, as I put it in the book, is you may not be able to change the world, but you can change lots of individual worlds, even if in small ways. And I think right now what holds us back is feeling a bit small next to the weight and the size of the problems. And so part of the reason I wrote the book, I think, well before anybody is entitled to write a memoir, you know, I have not brokered Middle East peace. I don't feel that I'm entitled to inflict upon the world my story, but I did want to show just the variety of pathways that one can take, whether as a journalist or as an activist or as an academic, or then finally as a staffer to a political figure and then as a diplomat myself. But, you know, that you do face those constraints. You get better over time if you're lucky at figuring out how to circumnavigate them. And then you can be part of things like ending the Ebola epidemic or getting the Paris Climate Agreement across the finish line. It doesn't mean that you won't be pulling your hair out when Donald Trump then undoes what you've done. But you can establish benchmarks that then can also provide norms or motivation for other people. You can promote LGBT rights within the UN, which has traditionally been a very homophobic place because of all of the laws criminalizing homosexuality around the world, and make inroads even on an issue like that just by investing in relationships, treating people with respect, building kind of unlikely coalitions of unlikely bedfellows. Again, it doesn't mean that there's no persecution of LGBT people because you pass something in the Security Council. The gaps can be enormous, but maybe you've taken an incremental step, maybe by getting the Security Council to denounce targeting on the basis of sexual orientation. Maybe some activist in some country now can point to that to use against their own government.
That sounds like that you're as much of a realist as you are an idealist.
I think I always have been. I mean, I think it's never my you know, I cut my teeth. I think we met not long after as a war correspondent in Bosnia, and I don't think you'd come out of that thinking, oh, wow, like the world is trending in a great direction and liberal democracy is going to triumph everywhere. I mean, you really saw not only the depravity of certain leaders on the ground and warlords and so forth, but also all that stood in the way of European and American powers stepping in to do something to rescue people. So my earliest experiences were seeing just how much gravity cut in the other direction, you know, toward a pursuit of a very narrow conception of self-interest that often came back to bite us, right? Because we weren't looking ahead and weren't seeing the degree to which, when you don't promote human rights, when you don't look out for the human consequences of your decision-making, that actually can harm your, what can feel pragmatic in the short term actually can prove very detrimental to your own interests in the long term.
How do you maintain your optimism, though, if you see so many things that you know are wrong and in your time as a war correspondent are deeply upsetting, that you know should be done differently, you try and effect change, the change is perhaps limited. How do you maintain optimism?
Well, I quote a great social scientist in the book who's asked why he's an optimist, and he says, "Why would I be a pessimist? If I were a pessimist, I would suffer twice," which is about the most pessimistic thing you could say, right? Because you'd suffer in advance, dreading something or knowing something's coming, and then it would actually happen. I think for me, it's more that I suppose it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you give up, then we're really toast, right? I mean, I'm not a great fan of President Trump, and I look at the 2016 election, and of all the dimensions to it that make me crazy, it's that 7% of the people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 stayed home in 2016, whether that was out of pessimism or out of optimism because they thought the election was well in hand. It's just an example of people kind of opting out and then there being really terrible consequences. So I think that's one dimension of it. But also, again, being in the government, even when I was felt I was banging my head against the wall, and Syria, of course, is the most dramatic example in the Obama administration of where no matter what we tried, we really were not mitigating the violence in the way that we had hoped to and that we sought to. But even there, you know, I could have given up and just said, oh, you know, we're at our limit, and we're kind of structurally, with all the disillusionment with the Iraq war, people in America are just tired. They're not even focused on Syrians in the way that I wish they were. I could have done that, but instead I decided to try to work with the Russian ambassador to at least get some number of Syrian political prisoners out of jail, you know, people whose names I knew, whose spouses I had met. Or I tried to work with him, which was, again, really hard to do because he was defending the indefensible from my standpoint, but to get humanitarian assistance to the part of the country that the Kurds are now fleeing from, thanks in part to U.S. policy. But again, it wasn't going to reach everybody. It was going to reach hundreds of thousands of people who would otherwise not have been fed. And so I think part of it comes from just finding, you know, what isn't the maximalist thing to do. Obama and I had an exchange that I describe in the book where I'm wanting to do something quite ambitious. He's saying Congress won't go along with it. Here's why. And I'm frustrated. And he says to me, "Sam, better is good. And you know what? Better is actually sometimes a hell of a lot harder than worse." And so I think that seeing one's ability, again, not to solve mammoth problems, but to make a dent in them, but also seeing the alternative of when you turn away, how much worse those problems become.
But what about America's role in the world? Some people see America as some sort of global policeman, but is that really the correct role for it? There are other people who see America as the cause of many of the world's problems. And then yet, when somebody like Donald Trump decides to start withdrawing America from places, suddenly there's uproar that, hang on a second, we need you there.
Well, I think both things can be true at once, right? That you can have a very powerful government, I mean, sort of like an elephant in a china shop, that's going to knock things over, and particularly given some of the decisions that have been made in recent years, it has with such power comes tremendous responsibility. And with such power, when you make a mistake like invading Iraq, I mean, the harms are impossible even to enumerate. There are so many harms to Iraqis, first and foremost, to the families of U.S. soldiers who were sent there, the terrorist movements that incubated there and that we're still dealing with to this day. And so there are major mistakes in American foreign policy history. But alongside that is a true fact, and I witnessed this firsthand as America's representative in the U.N., when it comes to big problems, countries don't just congeal and find collectively solutions. It's like, I would liken it in America to a pickup basketball game, right? Someone has to be saying, okay, I'm going to be the point guard. Who's my starting center? You know, who am I going to rely on? What's the division of labor? And I mentioned earlier Ebola. I mean, when President Obama decides that he's going to send 3,000 troops and health workers into the eye of the Ebola epidemic, when we were anticipating 1.4 million infections within just a few months, that was incredibly risky politically for him because he didn't even have much support among Democrats. But it empowered him and me and Secretary Kerry to go to the Cubans and say, okay, how many doctors from your Africa Corps are you going to contribute to dealing with Ebola? Malaysia, you make rubber gloves. Some of your companies, can you make tens of thousands of rubber gloves for the health workers who are active on the ground? East Timor, how about SIM cards? Can you give SIM cards for the contact tracing? And without a team captain, without that kind of catalyst who makes their own investment, catalytic investment, and then you try to leverage that to get other countries to do their share, maybe some other country can come along and do that at some point. China does not take those kinds of actions, but it was very helpful in the Ebola epidemic alongside us once we had, again, started to assemble the coalition. But I think you'd see and do see now a leadership vacuum. You'll see China acting beyond its borders in its own very, very narrow conception of self-interest, trying to rewrite the rules so human rights are less important internationally. But I think it's not a question of world's policemen. That's not, wouldn't be good for America. It wouldn't be supported by the American people, and it probably wouldn't be good for the world. But it is about leading and building coalitions of countries that have legitimacy to do the job.
Earlier in this interview, you used the phrase about tearing your hair out about Donald Trump and the Paris Accord, which you helped negotiate in your role as the ambassador to the United Nations. When you look at Donald Trump in office now, does that give you reason for some despair when you compare him with the President Barack Obama that you knew and worked with?
Yes, I suppose, on one level. But I wouldn't spend much time in that place because it just feels unconstructive, right? So it's more, oh, here he goes again, and then thinking through, okay, what is our pathway to ensuring that Donald Trump is not reelected? Because two terms, you know, if you love one term, imagine what two terms will not be two times four. Two terms will be irrevocable. I mean, fundamentally, the damage that will be done. I mean, imagine losing four more years on climate, for example. Imagine what the state of our alliances will be with our European friends after four more years of insults and a fundamental misunderstanding of how beneficial alliances are to the United States and to the American people. So I guess I just pivot quickly to, okay, what are we going to do about it?
But what are you going to do about it? How is he going to be beaten in the election this time next year?
Oh, I think he's very beatable. It won't be easy. He's got a lot of entrenched advantages, as any incumbent does, including bucket loads of money from corporations that have benefited hugely from the tax breaks he has offered them. As well as a very motivated base, as we know, that hasn't really budged.
And where is the Democrat to beat him?
Well, I mean, there are a number of candidates, again, who are front runners now, whether Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren, who each have strengths and can bring those strengths to bear. But to be very clear, just to get back to Trump, I mean, he's capped out at 41% approval rating, right? That I know sounds ghastly to a European ear, because it's like, who are those 41% of the country I know and visit and love so much, and where are these people, and what are they thinking, kind of, you know, given the lying and the corruption and all the rest. But so it's a high number, but you don't win with 41%. And remember, the last election, for all of the Russian interference, for the sort of inadequacies in retrospect of Hillary Clinton's campaign, for the lack of voter turnout, the last election was settled by 78,000 votes spread across three states. That's it. And so I don't know that Trump has picked up very much support, and his numbers, again, have gone down, not near enough as much as I would have liked to have seen over these years, but such that, again, that margin should be well within reach.
Okay, but Samantha Power, how do we get from 8 years of Barack Obama to Donald Trump being in power? Even if you leave aside those numbers and the explanation as to the voting patterns, what happened to America? The optimism that we saw when Barack Obama was elected, the joy, not just in America, but outside of America, to the way the country seems to be tearing itself apart at present.
Yeah, and I don't have a great answer. Again, I can give you chapter and verse, you know it all already. I think Irish people have dug into that question almost as much as Americans have in these intervening three years. But I think the toll of the economic recession, which again, let's remember what that was like. I mean, Ireland experienced its own version of it. I mean, just what it means for hundreds of thousands of people to lose their jobs, to lose their agency in their lives, their dignity. I mean, if you look at the opioid epidemic in the U.S. and where it has taken the most lives, which I think is one reflection of despair, a word you used earlier, among Americans, those areas graft onto the areas where Trump picked up an awful lot of popular support. And so a sense of disillusionment with institutions that led some voters who had, again, gone for Barack Obama in 2012, 9% of the voters who voted for Obama in 2012 shifted to Trump. I mean, so they were capable even of supporting this sort of reasonable person who was attached to science and, you know, very principled and free of scandal. That's the person they voted for overwhelmingly. And then they flipped, I think, feeling in the wake of the recession that the recovery did not come fast enough, that somehow America was kind of passing them by. And so, and I will say, in terms of foreign policy, those of us who were part of Obama's team underestimated the extent to which Trump's message of kind of being ripped off by the world, the idea that that message would resonate. We did not do a good enough job convincing, again, particularly those swing voters, people in the center, that our foreign policy was benefiting the American people above all.
Samantha Power, I want to talk to you a little bit more about you, because it is your autobiography, An Education of an Idealist. And I can imagine people listening to you and how clear and articulate you are would be amazed to read of the intense anxiety attacks that you have often suffered, the inability to breathe.
It's kind of important as first order priority when you wake up in the morning.
But yeah, to be that person, I think, will surprise people who have be familiar with you from radio and television interviews, seeing you in the positions you're in, that you have suffered that.
Yeah. And I had a choice, right, when I was writing the book as to whether to open up about all of that. But what I've come to realize since I became Obama's ambassador to the UN, especially, and had a more public role, is that when I brainstorm with people about what we might do about Trump or about some egregious injustice, you know, I would see in the eyes of the people I was talking to, oh yeah, easy for you to say, like, you were in the cabinet of the President of the United States, you know, I'm in my own struggle with addiction, or I have mental health issues or depression, or, you know, I've just made a terrible mistake professionally and I've fallen off the track that I thought I was on, or I have doubt about whether I can make a difference. I mean, that's where most of us live, right, is in the stew of the human condition. And so in the spirit of trying to open up a world of, you know, of service, of, you know, capital S or lowercase s, of trying to make a difference for others, of trying to promote human rights, I did delve into all of that. And it's been incredible just in the last couple months. I had expected my when I would go out and talk about the book at universities and so forth, to talk about the Syria red line or talk about Trump or talk about how we make up lost time on climate. And so many people just saying, you know, I've been struggling with addiction in my family and I felt responsible for my father and my inability to help him get help. And the fact that you also went through something like that just makes me feel kind of joined, and that it doesn't have to impede what I go on to do.
Samantha Power, it's been great having you here on The Last Word of Today FM. The new book is The Education of an Idealist. Samantha, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, former Wales coach Warren Gatland joined us in studio earlier in the week to talk about his new autobiography, Pride and Passion. Warren Gatland, of course, has brought Wales to two World Cup semi-finals. So I began by asking why it is that Wales can do that, but Ireland can't get beyond the quarterfinals, despite all the success of our provinces at club level.
That's an interesting question, that. So sometimes you need a bit of luck in sport. And so 2011, Wales played Ireland in the quarterfinal, and Ireland had won their group. And I think we...
I'm sorry, I had 12 players who had won Heineken Cups in the team.
They did, yeah. But I think technically we got that right that day. We went in there with a plan, and I think it took Ireland a little bit by surprise. And we played exceptionally well. And Ireland went into that game as huge favourites, and the expectation they were going to win that game and make the semi-final. So there was a lot of motivation for us in terms of going out there and getting things right. We played with probably the first time. So a lot of teams use it now. We play with sort of two fullbacks, and we shut down Ronan Ngara's kicking game and him being able to play for territory. 2:15 injuries, but unlucky. And then 2:19, you strike the All Blacks in the quarterfinals, having lost to Japan, you know. So it could have been completely different. So, so you need a little bit of luck.
It's not just, Jamie Heaslip told me the story about how in the 2011 quarterfinal, at halftime, you waited in the tunnel for the teams coming in, and you were shouting at your players, "We're fitter than them, we're stronger than them, we have them." And he said, it wasn't for the benefit of the Welsh players as much as you were putting more and more doubt into the Irish players' minds. You not only got them tactically, you got them you got them psychologically as well.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you're right about the success of the Irish provinces. And I think the structure in Ireland is fantastic. It's one of the best structures in world rugby. And the success of provincial rugby here is absolutely outstanding. And so from an international coach, it makes it a heck of a lot easier when you've got players coming in from winning environments, used to winning big competitions. And Wales, it's the other way. So our regions haven't been the most consistent. They haven't been the most successful. They won a few Pro 14s, but no success in Europe.
And yet consistently in your time at Wales, you were able to make a team that could win Grand Slams, that could win Six Nations, and twice got to the semi-final of the World Cup.
Yeah, but sometimes you turn that around and use that as one way. The success of players coming in, it's a real buzz, and you're buoyant and you come in with confidence. And for me, it's using the other side of things. So we go in there with an attitude about how hard we're going to work. No one works harder than us. No one trains harder than us. Trying to create Team Wales is almost like a club side, and so players look forward to coming in. You know, what can we do to make this environment special that's better than anything else, better than anything else that they've experienced at club level, better than anything else that maybe other players experience at international level. And we're very lucky in Wales with the facilities we've got. I think they're probably the best facilities in world rugby, and the players from the other home nations that have been there on Lions tours sort of come in there and go, wow, this is fantastic. In fairness to the Welsh Rugby Union, they see the national team as being so important, as the sort of the cash cow. And they've made a lot of investments into the national team and the facilities that we have up at the Vale. We've got the big indoor training area. We have two gyms, a pathway gym for the other teams, a gym just for the national team. Altitude chamber, that's one of the biggest in Europe, cryotherapy chambers, hot and cold, big medical centre. So the investment's been there, and I think players come in there and they go, wow, this is great. And there's no excuses. So we create a no excuse environment about the way we prepare, the way we train, everything provided for the players in terms of food and nutrition facilities, and I kind of and then how do we work? So, and that's been a model that's been really successful for us, and we have some values. And I said about hard work, some values about how important family is, and that's really come through heavily with the way that I help and prepare and coach a team. So every time the Welsh team come into camp in a squad, the first thing I'll say to them is, and I said this exactly the same with the Lions as well, just how lucky and fortunate we are to do what we do and to play professional sport and to get paid for it and get well paid. But the most important thing is your family.
But are you going to miss it, Warren?
I'm definitely going to miss it. I never ever thought I'd be in Wales for 12 years. I can remember the first month sort of walking out of my flat and or apartment in Cardiff, and I walked out and stood on the balcony and I said, right, that's one out of 48. Thinking I've got sort of 47 months to go before I finish my contract. And as it's gone on, I've just embraced it more and more and enjoyed it. I've really loved the last 3 or 4 years. And probably having the opportunity to do 2 Lions tours and sort of have those sabbaticals for a year and get away. That's been really good for me mentally, just sort of refreshing, working with other players, other coaches and stuff, and then coming back and being refreshed. I probably wouldn't have stayed that long if it was just a continual flow within the Welsh setup. But no, I have enjoyed it and I'm definitely going to miss it.
How much regret do you have over the fact that you did lose 2 semi-finals, one very controversially in 2011 when Sam Warburton was sent off by Elaine Roland, the Irish referee, yeah. And then even this year, because you made a far better fist of putting it up to South Africa than England did in the final.
Yeah, and I spoke to a few of the South Africans afterwards. I mean, England were amazing. They were fantastic against the All Blacks in the semi-finals, probably one of the best English performances that I've ever seen. And for whatever reason, they just didn't front up in the final. And spoke to a few of the South Africans on the Sunday night after the awards dinner. And, you know, they did say that they felt that the semi-final against Wales was a lot harder than the final was against England. And so at 16-all with 6 or 7 minutes to go, I thought, you know, we're going to win this. The momentum had sort of shifted our way. But we conceded a penalty to break down and then another one at a line out. And, you know, they kicked a goal. Pollard kicked a goal and we lost 19-16, but so really disappointed. But on reflection, I was just so proud of the guys.
This is a real hypothetical. If you had stayed with Ireland, you were let go in 2001, having won 4 games in that year's championship. Yeah. Had run New Zealand pretty close in your last game in charge in Lansdowne Road.
We were winning sort of until the last sort of 15 minutes, yes.
Okay. If you had stayed with Ireland, how much did you give time afterwards thinking as to what you might have achieved if you'd stayed with Ireland?
Well, I was disappointed with what happened because the plan for me and my own mind was to stay to 2003, do the World Cup, and then to finish after that. But I'm a great believer in what will be. Look, I was disappointed at the time, but then it's amazing how one door closes and another one opens and then my contract was up. I'd finished, you know, they said to me they're not going to recontract me, so I finished, you know, immediately. And within sort of 2 weeks, I had half a dozen job offers, and one of them ended up being Wasps in London, and a chance to go and live in London and experience life there.
With a great club team as well, yeah, some great players.
Yeah, well, at the time there, though, and one of the reasons I went there was I looked, they were bottom of the Premiership, and I looked at the team and went, how the heck is this team bottom of the Premiership? You know, they should be doing a lot better than that. And then we went there and we won 7 of our last 8 games or something, and then 3 premierships and a Heineken Cup and a Challenge Cup as well.
And a great semi-final, I hate to say, against Munster and Lansdowne Road as well. One of the great games of all time.
Oh, that was some game. And we played unbelievably well that game in the first half. And the plan was we were going to go after Ronan Nagara, and we went after Ronan Nagara, and Ronan went off after about 10 or 15 minutes, and I kind of went, no, that's not the plan. You're not supposed to go off. And Holland came on and was absolutely outstanding that day.
One final thing, we've gone way over the time. Yeah. I've been allotted, but I've really enjoyed the conversation, and there's so many more things I could ask you about if I had more time, but I want to finish up You do have the next British and Irish Lions tour to look forward to in 2021. And the fact that it's going to be South Africa, I mean, for them to win the World Cup and now to be host of British and Irish Lions is a fantastic way for you to have your third British and Irish Lions tour as head coach.
Yeah, absolutely. And to think this will be my fourth tour, the first one as an assistant. And three of those four tours will have been against the world champions. And so that makes it unbelievable in terms of the, you know, there'll be two in South Africa and the last one, obviously, in New Zealand. And if I look at it, I go, would have it been great for England to win the World Cup final? I think yes, from a Northern Hemisphere perspective. If I look at it from purely from a Lions perspective, and that I think England not winning is from a selfish point of view is good for the Lions, you know, because it creates a little bit more interest.
Perhaps a greater spread of players across the countries.
Spread of players, and probably less, you know, sometimes that British media can be a little bit, you can imagine, say, you know, well, if England had won the World Cup, well, why don't you just pick the England team to go and represent the Lions because they're good enough to beat the South Africans? Or if you lose the game out there, you know, why didn't you pick more English players or something? So I think the fact that they lost the World Cup final probably is a positive for the Lions in terms of, like you said, a reflection of the spread of more players and probably a little bit less pressure, which is an expectation. So I'm excited about it, really looking forward to it. It's a great country to go on tour. And
really unfair question. So if you were picking the Lions team to play next week, what would the split be between English, Welsh, Scottish and Irish? Oh,
I think in fairness, you want to see all the four nations represented. And I know a lot of Scots haven't been happy with me in the last couple of tours. And just, you know, I hope that that they can go and perform well and do well in the Six Nations and put their hand up. I mean, both Scotland and Ireland will be disappointed losing to Japan in the World Cup. So, look, there's a number of Scottish players that you want to do well, so that hopefully that they're represented with more numbers. I don't know what the split would be. I'm talking about eight games, and the tour schedule is going to be announced, and I think on the 27th of this month, I could probably see 15 or 17 English players, maybe not quite that many. It's probably seven or eight Welsh, maybe a few more Irish, and three or four Scots or something like that. So I'm just kind of thinking off the top of my head at the moment.
That's why it was probably an unfair question. Know the way rugby fans are, and they'd be thinking ahead to how many Irish players are likely to be there in the squad, how many will actually make the team, because it is something. It's a great event every 4 years.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely, and it's unique. It's iconic. It's something that, you know, we bash the hell out of each other during the Six Nations, and then afterwards we come together as one team, and that's what's special about the Lions and the fans from the four nations sort of getting there and supporting one team and going on tour. And I think it's absolutely brilliant.
We have to leave it there. The book, Warren Gatland, Pride and Passion. Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.
From with us here on The Last Word this year.
Yes, thank you.
And just to say, that was an edited version of the interview with Warren Gatland. And in the full podcast edition, he's very moving in talking about the death of his daughter in Galway. She was born with serious spina bifida. She died after 4 months. But it's a very, very moving part of that lengthy podcast, which you can get on the Go Loud app or on the Today FM app powered by Go Loud, or wherever you get your podcasts. And indeed, there's a lot of great podcasts there from throughout the week, including our latest Culture Club with Brian Kennedy, who had a lot of fantastic choices of music and books in particular. So I think you'll really enjoy that. We'll be back Monday to Friday next week, 4:30 to 7:00. In the meantime, you can listen to a few podcasts and then have a great weekend.